And welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And before I go on, I just want to tell you that we are podcasting now, and we also have shows archived on the website, penonfire.com. And what you do is you go to penonfire.com, and then you click on the radio tower on the left side of the screen. Go to the radio page, and you will see on the right-hand side of the radio page something to the effect of, you know, listen now or archived shows or something or other. And there's a few up there. And anyway, I also want to say that the opinions and views that you hear on the show are those of me and my guests, and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents. Today, my guests are Maura Conlon McIver and Mary Gateskill. First up is Maura Conlon McIver. She's author of She's All Eyes, Memoirs of an Irish-American Daughter, published by Warner Books. Maura graduated from the University of Iowa and has worked as a journalist, editor, and producer on both coasts. She holds a doctorate in depth psychology and lives with her husband in Portland, Oregon. Welcome, Maura.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation.
You're quite welcome. Yeah. Your book is so touching and poignant. And gosh, I know it just came out in paperback, and wonder if you would talk about, first of all, talk about how it came about.
Well, the book?
Yeah.
Yeah. I grew up in Orange County, California, and in an Irish-American, Irish-Catholic family. And my parents were from New York City, and my dad was an FBI agent, joined the FBI back in the Hoover days when, you know, just all men were in the bureau, and they wore the fedoras and the black coats and black ties and, you know, the old Inspector Erskine image from the FBI on Sunday nights. Anyway, so my parents moved to California back when California was a different place and had five kids. And this is a story about a young girl, myself, desperately wanting to get to know who her father really was, the man behind the mask, so to speak, of this mysterious FBI agent. So it's a father-daughter story, you know, primarily about the importance of those first 14 years of our life and how those first 14 years really shape who we become as adults. And I think for all of us, you know, we each have our coming-of-age story. What marked this particular story, in addition to growing up with this mysterious, powerful man who kept his heart and soul sort of buried deep inside, was also growing up with a brother who had Down syndrome, and that was our youngest brother, Joe. So I was mesmerized from an early age by these Joes in my life, my father, Joe Sr., and my brother, Joe Jr., both of whom had their own handicap, so to speak. My father could speak but hardly ever would, and my younger brother, Joe, longed to speak but couldn't because of his disability. So just that longing to articulate the love that sometimes gets lost is what motivated me to write She's All Eyes.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, coming out in paperback, it has a different title than the hardback had. It was called FBI Girl?
Right. The book was released last year by Warner with the hardcover title FBI Girl, and actually comes out tomorrow in paperback with a new title, She's All Eyes, Memoirs of an Irish-American Daughter.
Now, why did you change the title for the paper?
Well, of course, my fun answer is that FBI Girl decided to go undercover and change covers. But, you know, aside from that, it was an interesting process. When I was going around and doing book tour around the country, it was interesting because I would meet people who would say, oh, wow, I had no idea it was a book about family and coming of age and this father-daughter story. I thought this book was about a woman FBI agent and espionage. And so So I thought, oh, that's interesting, you know, because FBI Girl is the thematic unity that holds the book together. You know, this main character, myself, becomes an FBI girl at the age of 10, mimicking her father, hoping to get his attention. So thus the title FBI Girl. But because there was some confusion in the marketplace about the true content of the story and the storyline, we decided to launch it with a completely new title, one that portrays, you know, the fact that it's about family.
Interesting. Although in the book, you are very much an investigator. I mean, as a child, you're, you know, writing down license plate numbers and all sorts of things.
Oh, yes.
Could you feel back then sort of the seeds of becoming a writer? Did you see that in your future at all?
Well, what was the taunt for me is what I perhaps hinted at earlier. You know, in this discussion of the silence of my father and of my brother, and really this sort of larger familial silence. We grew up in a very quiet household. There are five kids, and we all were pretty quiet. And I will vouch for myself. I was voted the most quiet girl in eighth grade, and not particularly an award I was proud to receive. But, you know, it was just that quiet world in which I grew up, and I was so curious, like we all are as kids. I think we're all, in our own way, childhood spies in our house. You know, there's always this mystery about mom or dad or grandma or grandpa or the lack of them. And for me, the mystery was the silence. What's buried underneath it? So I had to become an investigator. I mean, there was clearly no other route for me to take, because the clues were the crumbs of silence.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I am with Maura Conlon MacIver, author of She's All Eyes, Memoirs of an Irish-American Daughter, out in paper tomorrow by Warner Books. Will you read to us?
Oh, I would love to.
That'd be great.
So, as I mentioned, I was trying to really connect with this distant FBI agent father. And so we're off to play baseball one Saturday morning at the local field, and I ask him if I can go and collect the baseball mitts from the trunk of his FBI car. And so here we go. I follow my father into the house, down the hallway lined with framed pictures of our New York relations. We're the only ones who live far away in California, just us four kids, dad and mom. I follow as Dad turns into his bedroom and walks straight over to his ash blonde dresser, which is a foot taller than the curls in my head. In the top left drawer, Dad stores his white folded handkerchief, chapstick, brown comb, and the little black pens that say U.S. government. In the middle drawer, he stashes car keys and blue and black covered booklets that say savings. In the top right drawer, Dad stores his badge and his FBI gun. I've never seen him stash the gun there, but I can tell it's in that drawer. When I walk past his dresser, slow, with crouched fingers like Nancy Drew, I feel that haunting gun stare at me. I keep the perfect distance, 3 feet away. I know if I get too close, the gun will go bang! And Dad will discover that I spy on him. He takes his keys from the dresser and thumbs through them as if they're dollar bills, then hands me the specific one for the trunk of the FBI car. The special key is as silver as the fish Mom cooks Friday nights. He looks at his watch like I have exactly 2 minutes to complete the mission. Go ahead and get the mitts in the trunk and come right back. Can I wear your mitt, Dad? Just get the mitts. I hold the key up to my chest, skip out into the hot and dusty sun, past the red rose bushes. I climb to thick, tangling, ankle-high ivy until I reach the trunk of Dad's black FBI car. The silver key fits, twists perfectly, just like the last time. It makes a poppy noise as I turn it, like the loud snap of bubble gum. The trunk lifts higher than my arms can reach, So I let it sail up like a kite into the air.
Hmm. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
That was Maura Conlon McIver reading from She's All Eyes. I wanted to ask you, well, a few things, but because this is about you and your family and relatives, I mean, this is so close. When you were writing this, did you worry about anybody reading it and having a problem, or did you just not even deal with it until it was written, or did you not deal with it at all? Because it's so not an offensive type of book, but even so, I think writers really have concern over, you know, when they're writing a memoir, over what family's going to think.
No, absolutely right, and it's a very good question. I think in this case, the main character in the book, well, my father, is passed away in 92, and I don't think I would have written the book or could have written the book had he still been living. In a way, my writing the book was my way trying to perhaps finally understand him. And I think with, you know, that whole issue of family and all of that, when you're writing about people and you're really going into detail about their lives, I think it's very much a strong consideration. With She's All Eyes, this is a book about my relationship with my father and my younger brother primarily. And so, you know, the book pretty much focuses on the three of us. So it was not a real critical issue with regards to protecting anonymity and you know, being concerned that I was letting out the dark secrets of somebody. But it's definitely an issue with memoir, no doubt about it.
Is She's All Eyes, is that the first book you've written?
Yes, this is my first book.
Excellent. Yes. Because so many writers with their first book have lots of books hidden away somewhere in the closet, in the garage, you know, that they wrote and learned how to write a book from, or that at some point gave up on marketing or whatever.
Well, I think that everybody has to decide for themselves why they're writing. And for me, I think there was a sense of, you know, part of it was the art and the love for language and the lyricism and story and drama and the unfolding of human relationships that are always told best in the form of story. And I think part of it also was a sense of a mission that I really felt the need to articulate the love that those in my family could not, for one reason or another. There's a saying that silence is handed down generation to generation.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that silence, I think, is a mask for trauma. And I think finally, you know, the next generation comes along and says, enough of the silence. What is underneath it? So there almost becomes like a mission associated with the writing and, you know, sort of to unearth those ghosts and to find out and to let them have their last wail before, you know, putting them in the ground forever and, you know, really trying to understand what the word tragedy means to a family and how our particular family in this story turned tragedy into blessing.
Interesting. I'm talking with Maura Conlon McIver, author of She's All Eyes. Just out in paperback tomorrow with Warner Books. Did you write the entire book before you tried to sell it?
I did, and it was such an important story for me to tell. And to be quite honest, it's a story I wanted to tell for many, many years. I won't tell you how many years went by before I finally sat down, and you know, the story was ready to spring forth for me. So. And you know what? I forgot your question already.
Well, just that, you know, with nonfiction, marketing often, you know, is sold on the basis of a proposal. And probably memoir is more difficult to sell that way just because there does need to be a story arc. And it is sort of a dramatic form as opposed to maybe other forms of nonfiction. So I was real curious, you know, if you decided you were just going to finish it all because you just needed to finish it and then market it or see what happened.
Right. So yes, that was my my decision was to write the whole story, and not worry about marketing and just try to make it as much a work of art that I possibly could. This is my first book. I didn't really know what I was doing. But I kept a quote by Terry McMillan close to me when I was writing the book, and her quote, to paraphrase, says something like, "Don't worry about lilting language and imagery and metaphor. Just stay focused on the people in your story, because it's people that readers really care about." And so I thought, well, I'm writing about really fabulous people, and so that gave me the confidence to go into it and to really pull the book out and let it rise from me. And then I was very fortunate when the book was done. I found an agent through an editor friend of mine, and the rest happened very quickly in terms of Warner picking it up.
Interesting. Yep. Yeah. Now, with memoir, I know a question a lot of writers often have is how much can you make up and how much has to be fact? For instance, if you're writing about something that happened long ago, you probably, unless you made it a point to write down the conversations at the time, you probably don't have exactly what was said in exactly the same way. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with reconstructing the past and have it be true?
Well, I think that there's the emotional truth that is the resonant part of writing memoir. I don't think you can write memoir truthfully without that emotional resonance when the words are coming from your pen. So I, for example, might not remember the color of my uncle's shirt, or I might not remember the exact texture of my father's shoelace. I mean, that kind of detail, but the emotional resonance of the relationship, what was felt at the time of verbal exchanges, those are with us forever. And I often think of times when I smell a chocolate cake, or I smell mothballs, or, you know, hear a particular song, and immediately I am brought back to an age when I am 8 or 14, or, you know, experiencing my first kiss, or my first, you know, the first time we experience these things in the early part of our life. So I feel that a lot of those memories are there deep inside of us. And for me, at least, the way to access those was to allow the images to come forth almost as if I was writing a poem. And I think, you know, when we read poetry, we don't say, oh, is that fiction or nonfiction? And I think with memoir, there's a bit of the poetic aspect to writing memoir, because you're getting at the personal and the universal through that vein of emotional truth. So it is a really unique process.
It's interesting what you just said, though, you know, the line between universal and personal, because it seems like the most gripping work, the most gripping memoirs are those that are extremely personal. And it's that, you know, intensely personal quality that also makes the piece universal. And that's such a paradox how that works, you know.
Well, I think you're hitting the nail on the head, Barbara, in terms of what story is all about. You know, story is what brings us together to remind us how we're all related, you know, how we're all interconnected, how we all long for love and meaning and deep relationships in our life, to feel like we're a part of something larger than ourselves, to feel like we're connected to people who came before us, you know, and the earth, and I mean, all of those things. I think that's hardwired into us as human beings, and we've become so modern, you know, and it's easy to forget that we still desire those things. So I think that the personal story is just a reflection of a universal longing to somehow realize we're all part of a larger story. We're all on this journey together, really.
Yeah, that's not true.
So easy to forget. And I think that's what literature does for us, is just tapping into the human condition, that larger picture that you don't think about when you're driving down the 405 or you're at the red light or at the supermarket.
Yeah. And memoirs, too, because because it's a memoir is based on truth doesn't mean that story is any less important. You know, I mean, your book has an arc. It has, you know, it's a story. You couldn't open it up in the beginning and get it, you know, from the, you know, I mean, you couldn't open it up in the middle and just pick up something, you know, I mean, you could pick up wonderful writing, but you have to start at the beginning. Whereas there are, you know, nonfiction books that are not memoir that you just pick up and you can jump around. And memoir is very much, you know, that story form, the dramatic form.
Well, I think that's the goal of memoir, is to try to find or try to make space for the dramatic tension underneath. And I think for all of us, you know, since this book deals with the first 14 years of life, it starts when I'm age 7 and finishes when I'm 14, I think we all can look back on our first 14 years of life and pick out a handful of things that were markers for us, that determined who we are today. It's the old alchemical metaphor of the wound becoming the blessing. And I think that whole process from lead into gold is really about, is really what writing is. It's like, well, this happened as an event, but what was the significance of that event? You know, from how it affected me, how it affected this other person, how it's viewed from their perspective, from my perspective. And then somehow working both perspectives, you arrive at some kind of particularity of truth that, again, I think is that emotional resonance of that was the attempt for something to be articulated at that moment that perhaps we didn't understand then, but we understand now in the writing of it.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, I think memoir completes the memory, if that makes any sense. We have these events happen to us. And they're kind of hanging out there like, you know, orbs. And we come in with our pen or our computer, and the process, I think, for me at least, becomes how do you stitch them all together so you can see the overall pattern that isn't evident until you start writing the story, or, you know, until you really start investigating how all of these disparate pieces are really part of the same tapestry.
Interesting. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I wonder if you have any words of wisdom for the writers who are listening.
Well, I would just say, first of all, don't listen to statistics about how hard it is to get published. I think that Jonathan Galassi, who is a longtime editor in the New York publishing industry, said something that I clipped out in a newspaper 20 years ago. And he said, if you write something good, it's going to find a home.
Mm-hmm.
So just stay focused on writing that good piece.
Yes, yes. Another thing that's so easy to forget driving down the 405, you know, it's like, yeah, it's about the writing, you know, forget about the trends, forget about what you think is selling, and what's the story you need to tell?
You have to start there or else it's not authentic, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, and I wish you the best of luck with your new paperback.
Thanks, Barbara. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
That was Maura Conlon McIver, author of She's All Eyes, tomorrow, out in paper by Warner Books. And she was speaking to us from Portland, Oregon. When we return, we will be with Mary Gaitskill, author of Veronica. Please stay with us.
Come back, baby. Please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. snow, little darling. Warm one belt in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
And hello again. Welcome back to Writers on Writing. You're listening to 88.9 FM KUCI. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at KUCI.org. And we've begun podcasting and archiving shows, if you can believe it. I've been talking about this forever, and it's finally happening. You can go to penonfire.com. And click on the radio tower on the left side of the screen. It'll take you to the radio page. And there you can download shows or at least listen to them. I don't know if you can actually download them, but you can do something. You can hear them live. We have a few shows from popular shows from a couple years ago that are on right now. Literary agent John Ware in New York City and short story writer Ron Carlson, Judy Blunt, and Robert Stone are all archived at this moment. So it's a wonderful thing. Before we go on and before I bring Mary on, I'd like to say that the opinions and views you hear on this show are those of me and my guest and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents. My next guest is Mary Gaitskell, author of Veronica, published by Pantheon. Mary is also author of Because They Wanted To, which was nominated for the Penn Faulkner Award in 1998. Her stories and essays have appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's Magazine, Esquire, The Best American Short Stories, and the O. Henry Prize Stories. And her story Secretary was the basis for the film of the same name. She has received a Guggenheim Fellowship, and she teaches creative writing at Syracuse University. And she'll be speaking to us from San Francisco, where she is on book tour and I believe going to Book Passage in Marin County tonight. Hi, Mary.
Hi, how are you?
Great to have you on.
Yes.
Your newest book, Veronica, is such a compelling read. And again, it seems to be the story of two women and their relationship. Very, very different from two girls, fat and thin, but the story of two women again. And I wonder if you would talk about how this story came about.
Actually, it was it's quite old. I wrote a draft of it back in 92, which is unusual for me to sit on something quite that long. But I wrote it, I forced myself to write it very quickly because at the time I was feeling, I think, impatient and irritable with my normal style of writing, which is quite slow and meticulous. And I was chafing a little under the feel of that kind of very refined style, and I wanted to, this story seemed to be something that I wanted to express in a much more immediate and raw way, and I made myself write it really fast. So I did a draft, though it was quite short. It was just over 100 pages in about a year. And the good part was that it was quite crude, and it had the advantages of crudeness, which it was very immediate and very fresh. But it also had the disadvantages of crudeness in that it was really quite clumsy and insipid emotionally. And I had a great deal of trouble working with it for that reason. I'd never tried to work with material that was quite that raw.
And so you wrote a draft in 92 and then just put it away, and then what?
Well, I didn't put it away right. I took it out in 94 and tried to rework it. And I didn't have, it was as if I didn't have the tools that were proper to work with the material. I was trying to write it essentially in the voice of Because They Wanted To, which is meaningless if you haven't read the book, but it's a very, again, very meticulous, piercing, refined voice, at least in most of the stories, and it just didn't work for this.
Mm-hmm.
And at least I had the sense to realize that and stopped after about 40 pages, and then I put it away, and I just kept taking it out and looking at it periodically, and didn't know what to do with it.
And then when did you know that, you know, it was time? When was it time?
2001.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Interesting. It's interesting. You know, I'm always interested in how we do that. You know, how we get, you know, some things we write, we do something with. Some things we write, we put away for a while. Others we totally get rid of and store or throw away, and then others, just the ones that call to us and say, you know, it's time for me.
Well, I think the thing with this is that I had the knowledge of it on a gut level, but it had not come up yet to a word level.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Interesting. Will you read to us?
Yes, I don't have something I can read at great length from, but how about something that's only about 2 minutes?
That's great.
Okay, this is the very beginning. When I was young, my mother read me a story about a wicked little girl. She read it to me and my two sisters. We sat curled against her on the couch, and she read from the book on her lap. The lamp shone on us, and there was a blanket over us. The girl in the story was beautiful and cruel. Because her mother was poor, she sent her daughter to work for rich people who spoiled and petted her. The rich people told her she had to visit her mother, but the girl felt she was too good and just went to show herself. One day the rich people sent her home with a loaf of bread for her mother, but when the little girl came to a muddy bog, rather than ruin her shoes, she threw down the bread and stepped on it. It sank into the bog, and she sank with it. She sank into a world of demons and deformed creatures. But because she was beautiful, the demon queen made her into a statue as a gift for her great-grandson. The girl was covered in snakes and slime and surrounded by the hate of every creature trapped like she was. She was starving, but couldn't eat the bread still welded to her feet. She could hear what people were saying about her. A boy passing by saw what had happened to her and told everyone, and they all said she deserved it. Even her mother said she deserved it. The girl couldn't move, but if she could, she would have twisted with rage. "It isn't fair," cried my mother, and her voice mocked the wicked girl. Because I sat against my mother when she told this story, I didn't hear it in words only. I felt it in her body. I felt a girl who wanted to be too beautiful. I felt a mother who wanted to love her. I felt a demon who wanted to torture her. I felt them mixed together so you couldn't tell them apart. The story scared me and I cried. My mother put her arms around me. "Wait," she said. "It's not over yet. She's going to be saved by the tears of an innocent girl, like you." My mother kissed the top of my head and finished the story. And I forgot about it for a long time.
Thank you very much. That was Mary Gaitskill reading from Veronica, published by Pantheon. Was that chapter always the beginning of the book?
No. Why do you ask?
Well, I'm just curious because it just seems like such a perfect beginning. Not quite a prologue, but, you know, really gives us the essence of the character we're about to meet. And so I'm just curious. I'm always curious about how books begin, you know, and if the first page is the first page of the first draft, or if after we have the first draft down, we go, you know what, it really begins over here.
No, it was this was a late edition, actually. But the very first draft, that the scene of the original first draft is still present in the manuscript, or in the book, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
But it's now halfway in.
Interesting.
It occurs on about page 101 or something. I don't remember the exact page, but it's about 100 pages in, and that was originally the opening scene.
So what happened? I mean, why did you what happened with your story that you said this is the beginning? This has to go here.
Well, those kinds of decisions are so intuitive; it's hard to say.
Sure.
But originally, the current version of Veronica is told in three different time frames that blend in and out of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the initial version was not like that. The initial version was all in the present time. And the narrator was looking back on a past, but it was a much more recent past. I don't remember exactly, but I think it was something like 3 years past.
I loved how you know, your character is in the present. And she, you know, lives in Marin County. She's cleaning for a friend. She's in physical pain. She's sick. And so much is told in flashback, but it doesn't feel like flashback. It's such an organic part of your book. It's most seamless, really.
Well, thank you. I think that's partly because, I mean, again, it was an intuitive decision to do that. But to me, I think as you get older, your feeling or your perception of time changes. And I think the way people think, or at least the way I think, and I can't imagine I'm alone in this, I don't make clear delineations between time when I'm going through a day thinking. The past and the present do weave in and out of each other. And in a sense, they're almost, they can be seen at the same time. They can occur simultaneously on a certain level. Some people believe time is a completely an illusion that allows people to organize their existence. I don't know if that's true or not, but it makes sense to me.
Sure. It's interesting. The voice is interesting in that it's a present tense. Your narrator's speaking in the present tense. I wonder if, was your story always that way as well? Or, you know, how did that come about? How did you decide to tell this story in the first person present tense?
Well, again, I don't know. And that changed a couple of times. The very first draft was in the third person, and then it changed to the first person, and then I think when I picked it up again in 2001, I entertained the idea of a third person and quickly went to the first. I think whenever you write in the first person, you're going for immediacy. I think is mainly the the quality of the first person. And it is sometimes told in the past, like I almost needed to tell it in the present, because a way to signal to the reader that I'm now in the past is by using the past tense. Like there's a lot of line breaks,
mm-hmm.
and I can go from past to present in paragraph to paragraph. So if there's a line break, that's one signal, but then also that if I've changed into past tense, the reader obviously knows. But sometimes I actually blurred them and actually had two different time frames in one paragraph and had them both in the present tense. And I had some mild worry about people being confused by that. I was willing to let them be confused, but what I've been very pleased by is that it apparently didn't confuse many people. People who have gotten back to me have said that they were surprised that they were not confused by that kind of mixing that occurred in some paragraphs.
Yeah, I didn't feel confused.
Well, yeah, I'm glad, because that meant I did it well.
Yeah, you did do it well. You did it very well. And a minute ago, you know, talking about this, you said you worried that maybe it would be confusing, and I just want to segue to something I perceive from your writing, and that is that you seem quite fearless. You know, you have an admirable quality as a writer, where the feeling is that you really don't care what people think. You're going to tell your story, and you're going to be true to the story you need to tell, and hopefully your readers will get it. Hopefully, you know, your books will be read, and if not, oh well. I could be so off the wall with that, but that's just the sense I get from your work. You're just, it's out there, and if we want to read it, great, and if we don't, great.
Well, I don't, that's a kind of attitude that I have to have in order to write. I'm not fearless, though, in a certain sense. While I'm writing, I'm actually quite fearful, although not about how it's going to be received, at least not consciously. It's more that I'm afraid that I'm not up to the task I've set for myself, that I can't. Like this book was extremely hard to write, and I just kept thinking I can't do this, because I sometimes am afraid that the images that I have in my head, and they're mostly images. I tend to think in images, and they're often so complicated, and I just don't feel like I can come up with the words for them.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I can't, and it's enormously frustrating, and sometimes I'm just afraid that I'm simply not adequate to what I have to do. But that's more where the fear comes in.
Mm-hmm. And yet, you do pull it off.
Well,
by all appearances, you pull it off. Is it something that, you know, as you said, you know, you're afraid you know the words aren't coming to you. What do you do then? I mean, do you just wait? Do you go do something else and come back to it? Do you, you know, I mean, what changes?
I do sometimes come back to it. I sometimes, you know, sit there and pound my head on the wall for a little while and just, you know, rewrite it over and over again. And sometimes I have to settle for something that isn't perfect in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Interesting. We are talking with Mary Gateskill, author of Veronica, published by Pantheon. You also teach. You teach writing
mm-hmm.
in New York. How does teaching affect your own work? Or does it?
Well, when I'm doing it, it affects it simply because it takes up a lot of the same energy. It's a little bit of a problem because it kind of draws on the same parts of your brain, I think. And or not all of them, but it just literally takes away time. But in terms of other ways, I don't know. It probably does affect it somehow, but I'd be hard-pressed to say exactly how.
Mm-hmm. Do you read while you're writing
Yes.
other people's work? What are you reading now?
Right now, what am I reading? I've been reading a lot of short stories because I'm teaching a literature class as
mm-hmm.
well as creative writing. I've been reading stories by a lot of John Cheever, who
mm-hmm.
I didn't used to like as much when I was younger, but I'm really liking him now.
Yes.
James Joyce, Gogol, Chekhov, who I also am really loving in a way that I didn't when I was younger,
mm-hmm.
Nabokov, Murakami, Catherine Ann Porter, George Saunders.
Interesting. You write short stories, and I'm wondering if you prefer the short story form over the novel form, or the novel over the short story, or does it just depend on the material?
Well, I find short stories, at least, I'm more experienced with that form. I mean, I've been writing short stories since I was, I started in a serious way to write short stories when I was 21. I'm 50 now. So I find them much more comfortable, and they just require a lot less, they're much less demanding in terms of time and attention. Not that they're easy, but they're easier as far as I'm concerned. But this is only the second novel I've written. No, I'm working on another novel now. But my suspicion is, though, I'm going to be more drawn to novels in the future. In the last 10 years, or not that long, maybe last 7 years, I haven't written as many short stories. And I've had an unusual and frustrating experience where I've started to write several stories that I just couldn't finish. And that just doesn't happen to me very much. And it happened like 5 times in a row in the 90s, late 90s. And it was a really scary thing because I felt like I was losing my ability. And I think what it was is I was changing. My aesthetic was changing. My whole method was changing. It was like I was trying to look out a window that wasn't there anymore. And I think I was also, those stories were trying to be novels.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they didn't work.
Hmm. Interesting. We have another couple of minutes left with Mary Gateskill, author of Veronica, published by Pantheon. As you said, you're working on another novel. Are you suspicious about talking about it or sharing it with others until you have a draft, or do you have readers, or what point do you bring people in and start showing your work?
I don't have readers. The novel I'm working on, I have shown to my editor. I'm 160 pages into it. And I showed it to her just to, reassure her that I actually was doing something. also just to see what she would feel about it. She doesn't make detailed comments. I don't want detailed comments when I'm first writing something. I do show things to my husband. He's the only person I really show anything to.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, it's been wonderful talking with you. I'll tell you, I wasn't sure you would actually come on the show because of a line or two on page 5 of your book where your character, how does it go? It's, I drink my coffee out of a heavy blue mug watching the rain and listening to a fool on a radio show promote her book. And I thought, I don't know if I'll bother asking if she'll come on this one. But then I thought, well, maybe I'll just ask. It could just be the character. And well, so...
it is. I mean, it has some basis in how I feel sometimes. I mean, in the past, I've heard myself on radio. I've heard myself on tape. And it's not that I... It just sometimes I just listen and I go, God, you sound like a jackass. I mean, not because I was saying anything stupid in particular, but just blabbering on and on and... It's like you can become very facile because you do these interviews and you get very accustomed to making very polished sounding answers to your questions, and from a certain point of view you can say well that's a fool, but it's a lot of different places I'm speaking from when I write a character.
It's just been wonderful to have you on, and I just wonder if before we go if you have any advice for the writers who are listening, who are struggling through finishing something?
I don't really, because I think it's so individual that what will work for one person will not work for another. I think people have an idea that, I mean, to me the whole group dynamic and writing groups and discussion groups is very foreign to my experience. To me it's something that must take place very much alone, and you need to really feel your way along almost blind, but that may not be that may not be a useful image for anyone else.
Actually, I think it's quite appropriate, you know, because there is no one way. You know, there's no one answer that's going to take care of it all. So I think that was quite appropriate.
Okay.
Thank you so much. And continued good luck on this book. You've been getting wonderful reviews and lots of notice. And that's great.
Well, thanks.
You're welcome. That was Mary Gaitskill. She is in San Francisco on book tour. And if you're up north, she'll be over at Book Passage tonight at 7. And it's a wonderful bookstore and great events. So leave now, and you will get there in time. If you want to know more about the show, you can go to my website at penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower, and we'll take you to the radio page. You can access those archived shows, and you can email me if you'd like to be on my weekly email list. Again, it's penonfire.com. I want to leave you with a quote by Alice Walker, who said, "Deliver me from writers who say the way they live doesn't matter. I'm not sure a bad person can write a good book. If art doesn't make us better, then what on earth is it for?" Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI. I am still Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'll be back next week with another wonderful guest or two. So come back. See us again.
Here's to my lost youth, and here's to where it went, and here's to all my old friends, and the good times that we spent. Things will never be like they were back then. Don't you know you can't go home again, and you can't go home again. And I once was a child, summer's day, running with the wind, laughing all the way. And deep within my heart, someone says, "Hey friend, don't you know you can't go home again? You can't go home again." And I guess I've